Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode here of Suspense Radio. My name is John Robb. I am your host for this 90-minute show we have today, and it's going to be a little different format. We are going to have guests Kim Harrison and Tasha Alexander on the show today, but for the first half hour, I have no guests because there's some things I wanted to talk about and lessons I wanted to give before we get on with our guest today. So therefore, you're going to have a little bit different Suspense Radio than you normally do. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be exciting. So sit back, relax, because 90 minutes starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it. I think you're going to feel you belong.
Everybody was paying attention this past week. There was a lot of big news that happened in the publishing industry. The biggest thing is that Random House and Penguin have signed a merger deal, and therefore the two houses will now become one. So basically taking the six, Big Six, down to now the Big Five, where now this is the world's largest publishing company. I've seen anywhere from about 25% to 30%. That they are going to now own in the publishing business. But you have to think, what does that mean to me? It means two different things, whether or not you're a writer and whether or not you are a reader. And I said this about a year and a half ago, and I knew that this was coming, is that you're with the change of Amazon and the Google Books and the Apple iBooks and all the sites that are coming up to where, you know, people can now put their own books on the internet and not have to go through an agent process or a publisher process and just say, well, my mom loves it, so I'm publishing it, and you can do that. And people are making a lot of money at that. There's a lot of authors out there that, you know, basically are writing very basic books and making a lot of money because they're marketing it correctly. So what does this kind of mean now? So you have to look at it from two different aspects. Like I said, you got the author aspect, and now you have the reader aspect. As far as the reader goes, I don't know if you're going to see that big of a change between the two, because the books are still going to come out and things like that. That you're still going to read on Barnes & Noble, wherever you get everything. As far as an author standpoint, it creates a little bit more of a havoc. A lot of agents are not happy with this, and it's never happy when you have two places that are now merging together this big to create one, because it gives a little bit less sense of competitiveness. Now you have one less publisher that you can compete with as far as an agent trying to sell books and trying to get their authors published. So it kind of hurts a little bit in that way, and I can definitely understand. The problem is that it was almost a given that it had to happen, because here's the thing, publishers do publish books, and that's right, but the one thing that they've always needed is the engine to sell the books. They needed the bookstores, they need the Amazons, they need the Googles and the Apples and all the other sites, because they have no brick-and-mortar stores. They have no really place to buy them unless they have places to sell them. So they're kind of at the mercy of the Amazons in those places. And so what that means is now that they can become, it's going to go one of two ways. You know, the Penguin had Book Country and they were trying to find authors that way, people posting stories, and you find those places out there. Amazon uses that also to where if they find authors that are selling books on their site extremely well, they are now signing those authors to their publishing houses. They have Thomas Nelson, they have 47 North. Well, Penguin decided to try to do the same thing, and I don't know how much of a success it's been. I haven't really seen any numbers, so I can't comment. And I won't, but I can't imagine that it did a lot of different, a lot of things, because what I did was that I kind of tested this, and I did this as a fan, and I wanted to see what the difference was, because as a reader, you get confused. You go to Amazon, and you decide, hey, I'm going to buy a book. Okay, great. So let's say you got $10 to spend, okay? And you're going to buy an e-book. We're going to stick with e-books here because it's easy. So you want to buy an e-book. You got $10 to spend. You got your Kindle. You're out there, and you're looking. Well, here's the problem. So now you're looking, and you start seeing these books. Ooh, $1.99. Wow, you know, I can get 5 books for $10. It's a great deal. And you start reading it, and, you know, hey, it reads well, and it's the subject matter you like, and you decide, hey, I'm going to go ahead and get that. You get that $1.99 book, you start, you open it, you read it, you realize that, like I said, it was, you know, Joe Smith or whoever sitting in the basement of their house deciding, hey, my mom liked my book, and I decided to put it up there. So you spend $1.99 without really knowing what you're reading because you didn't really do the research, and I always say people, you still need to have the books that go through a process of editing that's not a family member, okay? The thing that publishers do and the things that they do very well are they legitimize authors in saying, you've been through the process, you have, you know, been through the ringer and everything else, and therefore we know that your book is a solid read. Now, whether or not the subject matter is something everybody's going to like, it's still going to be a solid read. It's going to be well written. It's going to be grammar. It's going to be copy edited. It's going to be all those fun little things, and you're already going to know. What you don't know when you go to Amazon and these places and you buy these Kindle books, you don't know if those books have been through that process. So as an author, the merger means you're going to have less places to sell. And it's coming again because HarperCollins has already said they're basically pimping themselves out. They basically want to merge. It says it here in the article that I pulled up from the New York Times. You know, HarperCollins wanted to do this about a year ago. And I thought it was going to happen with Simon & Schuster. I really did. I kind of had a little back, source that said, hey, you know, watch for this. Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins could very well go together, and that very well could happen. It looks just like Random House and Penguin kind of beat them to the punch. And these typically are when the dominoes begin to fall. When one decides, let's do it, then the other is going to fall. So now is it all more difficult for authors to get published because publishing houses, you know, they don't have the resources. They don't have the money anymore. They're losing a ton of money. I could see, you know, publicists and people and editors being laid off because of this merger. I don't know if they're going to take on any more new books. I think they're going to do a lot of their backlist books and stuff like that. And they both have tremendous, you know, authors and books that they have in their stable. I mean, let's face it. I mean, if you had to try to rank, I mean, you can almost put Random House and Penguin 1 and 2 in any kind of order, and you'd be fine with that. So so like I said, so as poor authors, now they're going to have to, you know, struggle even more to try to find their home and try to find a place for their writing. And agents I know are not actually happy about that either. But, you know, like I said, you know, business is business. That's what's going to happen, and it's going to happen more. The publishing industry just took a little bit of time to catch up to what the record industry and what CDs and DVDs and the movies and what they've already done, and they've already had to been through the ringer. And that's just the way we are now in society, and that's just what's going to happen. So get used to hearing more of these stories. Like I said, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it's a change in the tide. We have to see with everything. You have to kind of see what it is. People are going to have theories about it's going to be bad for this, it's going to be bad for this, blah, blah, blah. No one really knows until you give it a year, until they're fully together, until you start seeing the things that they start bringing out, will you know if it's good or bad? I will say just watch it and watch for others. I'd love to hear from any authors. You can email editor@suspensemagazine.com. I'd love to hear if you've had any problems. You know, what are they saying out there? What are the struggles that agents are having? I know that they're taking on less titles, and I know that they're marketing a lot less titles. And I don't know if this is going to affect that. So we'll have to wait and see. Our November issue, switching gears here a little bit, our November issue of the magazine is being done. And I got to say, coming in December, I did a really great interview with Richard Belzer. And if you don't know Richard Belzer, of course, he's a stand-up comedian. His character Munch has been Law and Order, and he's been all over and on Homicide. And he's written a couple books. He's a very good writer. He started out as a reporter, working for newspapers. He's a very good writer. And he wrote a book along with an author called David Wayne that is out, came out in August, and it's called Dead Wrong. And it's not a conspiracy theory book, so I don't want people to think that. What it is what Richard calls it, and I'm not going to get away too much in the interview, but he kind of calls it a book of fact, and you get a lot of factual stuff. But there's a lot of things in that book and a lot of research that he did that when you read this, and I say everyone should pick it up, whether you believe in the subject matter or not, that's not the point, okay? The point is that it's a book that you should pick up for the sheer fact of just expanding things that you might have questions about, you know, just little things. And he goes through a lot of different things, but just talking to him on the phone, it was just really great to interview him. I mean, he was so a very gracious guy. Sat on the phone for a good, 25, 30 minutes, and we just kind of talked back and forth about his book and things like that. So you're going to see that interview in December. Also in December, of course, is where we're going to have our best of for 2012, and so we're going to have that in the issue, and that's always a very popular issue. So if you haven't emailed editor@suspensemagazine.com to get your 4 free issues, that's all you have to do. Your email addresses will not be sold. They will not be used for anything else. Simply, you will get your magazine via email. And if you're not on with reading magazines online, you better get on, because the other story that came out is one of the biggest newspapers in the United States, in the world, is Newsweek. And in 2013, you're not going to find a piece of paper anymore, or you're not going to find a hard copy of Newsweek. That magazine is all digital now, people. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we did this about a year and a half ago. We had to go all digital. And people ask, well, why do you have to go all digital? I don't like to read my stuff on the computer. Well, I'll tell you why. Because it's freaking expensive to print a magazine. It's even more expensive to get advertising dollars to be able to print the magazine. And that's how you have to run it. You don't run a magazine off subscriptions. That's why people give them away for free, because they want their numbers to be up. They want their numbers to be high. And that attracts advertisers. And the problem is that it's a false number. Okay, so when people say our circulation is 75,000 or 100,000, okay, that's how many you're printing. That might be how many you're sending out. But a ratio that it makes a magazine extremely good is 30% sell-through. So if you're saying, hey, I'm doing 100,000, you're only really selling 30,000 eyes. That's all you're really getting. Now, you might have some people that are getting, you know, reading it here and there or whatnot. But that's the kind of, like I said, that's kind of the misnomer of looking at printing to digital. Now, I know exactly how many people read our magazine digital because we have statistics. We know who opens it. We know how they open it and things like that. And that's why a lot of people are going to go digital. Newspapers, there's already newspapers that are cutting out 2-3 days during the week. You're only going to get it 3-4 days maybe during the week now. So I want you to try it out. You know, you can run it on your iPad. You can read it on many different things. And just email us. Let us know. You'll get the November issue. That is being finished up. We just had, you know, October, which was a great one. And so it's great to be able to bring this to you, and hopefully you guys all enjoy it. It's a lot to put together. And we expanded our review section and we interview section, and we just did a lot of great things. I'm also on Amazon right now, and I'm kind of looking because this is kind of the time when people start looking at, oh, you know, what's coming out for the holidays and what kind of books are coming out. Well, just sitting here on the new releases, and I tell everybody that they need to do this. You should do this probably, you know, once every 2 weeks, right, as they update it, just to kind of see what's kind of coming out and get an idea of what's going on. Because there's some great books that are out there. I mean, by all the big authors are all coming out around this time. I mean, just looking at the tops, you know, you have Patricia Cornwell that came out with another K-Star Peta book in October. You had The Racketeer by John Grisham that just came out. James Patterson, the guy writes, the guy sends out so many books every year. He has another one coming out. It's like once a month. The other thing that you're going to notice is Michael Connelly, James Rollins, a couple other people, they're starting to put out a lot of Kindle singles, a lot of $1.99s, and they're starting to do this not just because they can and because it makes money, but now it kind of it gives them the ability to say, you know what, I got the story in my head. I don't really know if it's worth a book, but it's definitely worth a short story, and they're able to do it, write it, boom, say it out there. Don't even have to worry about the publisher. They don't really have to go through that. They can go through anybody to kind of do a short story, because it's something different. This, however, was, you know, Going Through Hatchet by Michael Connelly. Another James Patterson, which one he did write, which is Merry Christmas, Alex Cross. Another thing. It's great to see Vince Flynn with his book coming out in November, another Mitch Rapp book. Justin Cronin with The 12, which is book two of his Passage trilogy, Iris Johansson. Jay and Ivanovich, C.J. Lyons. I mean, everybody that you want. David Balducci. They're all coming out. The other thing that is starting to get a lot of popularity is Ian Fleming's James Bond series. They always kind of do this when a new movie comes out. And Skyfall comes out next weekend, which I'm very anticipating to see. I really want to see that movie. I'm a huge James Bond fan. It looks fabulous. So I'm really excited to see that movie. I think it's going to be just wonderful from the trailers and the previews and everything that I've seen on it. I think it's just going to be a fabulous movie, and I can't wait to get into it and see what's going on. There is something, however, I guess, on Wikipedia. If you're a Bond fan, do not go on Wikipedia and search flipping Skyfall, because you're going to be pissed because there's spoilers in there, and you don't need to, you know, you don't need to do that. You don't need to go on there and look at spoilers, because that's just, I think that's just bull when people do that. So, you know, I wouldn't even worry about that. But just stay away from Wikipedia and James Bond and go see the movie next weekend. I have a feeling that I think that you're going to love it. And that's you know, and I'm curious to see it too. But the other thing is, I'm going to do like a little short kind of lesson. And I just did an interview with somebody. And they ask me the questions, and I get this all the time. And there's so much information out there, I really don't know why people do not research this more. But here's the deal. People want to know, what makes a good story? Why do we reject a story? Why do we publish a story? And here's the simple fact, and this is what I did. And I wrote this answer, and I wrote it in two parts. A short story and a novel are two different things. And I'll tell you, in a short story has to be more plot-driven. And with characters that are intriguing, but they don't need to be fully developed. You can just kind of mention their backstory of what happened, why they became crazy, or why they're on Xanax and drinking vodka, or whatever they're doing. You just mention it, okay? They had a screwed up childhood or anything else. But it's the plot. Because you only got about 5,000 words in a short story. At least that's what you have in our magazine. That's all we're looking at, 5,000 words. So what you need to do is you need to think of the plot and don't worry about the characters' development so much. Just make them intriguing, because you're not going to have a lot of time to be an emotional attachment to the reader. They're just going to use the characters as kind of the platform of the story. Now, novels, much different thing. When you have... you basically have a limited space. You can write a 300-page book. You can write a 900-page book. It all depends on what you want to do. The character is the most important part. And here's why I say that. You can go out and you can buy CDs. You can buy books. You can buy anything, and they'll say 1,000 different plots. You know, here's our plots for a mystery, and here's our plots for a thriller and a suspense. And they've kind of already had them, you know, they're already out there. You have a plot, you just kind of change the tune a little bit. Whether or not you're writing about more technology stuff, whether or not you're writing about old English things or whatever. You know, murders have always been written in the page, and there's really not a lot of different things that people can write about plots except just making them stranger. So since plots have already, you know, you're not going to really find a brand new book that someone probably hasn't written a plot line about. But the one thing that you are going to have is you can have new, exciting characters, and that's what you need to focus on as an author. Work on your characters first. Work on your, you know, I always say work on your city. You have to build the foundation of a city before it becomes a city. The entire city is your plot. But the people who live in the city are what make it run. Because if you have this, if you have a city that looks like New York with the great skyline and all the great stuff and everything they have on, but it's empty, who cares? There's no one in there. There's no one living there. There's no characters in there. There's no one walking around. So what's the difference? So you need to think of your main character, your villain, who's going to support them and who's going to come in, and how are they all going to kind of intermesh with each other, and then work on the plots to go around their personalities, around who they are, to kind of fit in. And you can change things as you go along. There's no harm in saying, I'm going to change this, I'm going to change that a little bit. The characters can start writing themselves. You know, one can be a little bit more funny than you wanted it to, or whatever. Who knows? But that's what you can do. And that's what you need to do when you write a novel. Is think of the characters first, then write your plot around them. And that's the biggest thing that I said, and that's the thing that I wanted people to know. Novels should be character-driven, because that's where the emotion comes from. That's where the people keep buying the books. Short stories, plot-driven, because you have a very small space to fit your story in, and you need to still have a beginning and a middle and an end. So those are that, boys and girls, is your lesson for the day. And your lesson is basically write, you know, is what you kind of have to do. I am so flipping thirsty today. It's basically write and get it on the page and get yourself going. And that's the most important part of this whole thing. So what we're going to do now is, we're going to take a short break while I get our next guest, Kim Harrison, on the phone, bring her back. You're going to know her, KimHarrison.net. Of course, number one New York Times best-selling author. Her latest book is called Into the Woods. It's Tales from the Hollows and Beyond. It's a dark urban fantasy. We're going to talk all about Kim. We've had her in the magazine. I've never had her on a radio show. It's going to be great to be able to talk with her and see everything that goes on, because this is a genre that is exploding, people. And I recommend that you guys go out and not only pick up Kim's book, but get a book in the genre to start reading it, because it's not just for, you know, dark urban fantasies. It's not for teens. It's for adults. It's for everyone. And I think Twilight and those kinds of books have proven that. And Kim is another author that is definitely reaping the rewards of this genre being outstanding. So, again, we will be back here and a little post-Halloween song by Iron Maiden. Welcome everybody back here, and hopefully you've enjoyed a little bit there of Fear of the Dark, which I think was a little appropriate right after Halloween was on. But now, like I said, we are transitioning here into our first guest of the show, Kim Harrison, New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is called Into the Woods. And Kim, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
Thanks, John. I'm doing good, as always, and I am glad to be talking with you guys today.
Yeah, it's always exciting. The book came out just early October, so just a little less than a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Into the Woods, Tales from the Hollows and Beyond. So can you kind of give everybody a little bit of behind the scenes about the book and kind of let them know what's going on with it?
Absolutely. Well, as you said, Into the Woods just came out. It is a compilation of just my own work. My editor came to me and said, we want to put all the short stories and novellas that you've done for The Hollows in one place, but we need to have you write some new stuff, too. So I took her at her word, and so I wrote up three new novellas that have nothing to do with The Hollows, and actually, this is fear-based. What I did was fear-based, quite honestly, because The Hollows is coming to an end. It's going to end at 13 books. Now, before you panic, we're only at number 10 right now, so we've got a ways
got a
to go
to
yet.
Go.
Yes.
You got the trilogy left. You got the big,
yes.
big climactic trilogy.
Mm-hmm. I'm already starting to think about it. In fact, we're doing the rough draft for that last book right now. And when I had the opportunity to write some new stuff, I thought, well, what do I want to work on after I get done with The Hollows? So I took advantage of it, and I pulled out three ideas that I had out of my cabinet of awesomeness that I had kind of played with before, and I developed them into brand new stories. And it was kind of a double-edged sword because none of the stories that I worked on have anything to do with The Hollows, but they're not really the stories I want to tell after The Hollows. Some of the characters are younger in the stories I wrote than in the series that I might develop. And so my editor is seeing kind of a skewed vision, and so it's double-edged in that she's seeing the world that I want to work in, the magic, kind of the pacing, the flavor, but not really all the characters. And she and I are both very character-driven in what we like. So we'll have to see. The three that I did, one was Spider Silk, and that's kind of a horror bent. And then another one I wrote was Grace, which is the more modern world. And the magic is kind of, it's out in the open, but there's no werewolves or vampires, so that was completely different. And so I'm really trying to stretch my writing a little bit and dip into different kind of genres, which urban fantasy is known for.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing about dark urban fantasy is kind of it's, chameleon-like approach to be able to do many different kinds of things within the subgenre on its own. You almost have to label it kind of with horror, and I always say kind of horror is that genre that kind of has no rules, because
mm-hmm.
you can do any kind of thing you want. If you have a thriller, you have to keep it all fast-paced. If you have suspense, you kind of have to roller-coast people, and mm-hmm. mysteries, of course, it's kind of like a whodunit. But you're kind of in the genre where you don't really have a lot of rules because you're creating everything that people see, and you're doing it strictly all out of your mind. And that's kind of an exciting thing, but it's also a very daunting task.
Well, I will agree with that to a certain extent. There are rules, but they aren't already laid out. Each author, when they start writing in this genre, will borrow other rules from other things they've read, but they will make it their own. Like you said, they're making it all up, but they have rules, and they have to stick to those rules that they've set down, which can get pretty daunting after you've put, like, 12 books on paper. You start tripping over yourself. But, urban fantasy is absolutely wonderful in that you can bring in the mystery and the horror and the science fiction, and there's a lot of romance in certain areas of it. Now, not all urban fantasy is romantically oriented. In fact, some is completely, opposite. But you will tend to get romance readers picking up your book. And the young adult has absolutely exploded into the dark urban fantasy genre. And it's really great to see because these are the readers of the next generation, and I am so pleased that they've got some good literature to look at right now.
Right, and I was going to get into that here and about kind of dark urban fantasy, but the one thing is, within the three stories that you have in there, was there one in particular, and I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Kim Harrison, and kimharrison.net is her website, so we're going to have to try to get you that .com domain. It could be a little confusing. People are like, oh, kimharrison.com. Oh, my God, where's
she at? That's the lobster lady. That's not me.
Yeah. So kimharrison.net is the author. So with the stories that are in there that you wrote that you pulled out of your awesomeness cabinet, was there one kind of in particular that either gave you a lot of trouble or something to the effect of it was a little bit different maybe or than you thought it was going to be, because it wasn't all straightforward?
Yes, there was. Spider Silk actually gave me a lot of trouble. This is probably the most horror-oriented piece of work that I've ever worked with. And I'll be honest with you, I'm terrified of horror. I don't like horror. You know, things that make me jump and go, ew, no, not really me. But the psychological bent that you can kind of tap into in the horror, that fascinates me. And I tried my hand at writing something with a more of a psychological horror bent to it with Spider Silk. I've got three generations of women in a lonely farmhouse. So, you know, I've got the elements there, and I've got this spirit that may or may not be real. It might be just a psychosis being handed down from grandma to mother to daughter. And at the end, we're not sure actually who's in that cave. Was it the spirit? Was it the woman's boyfriend? Did she just commit murder, or did she just save her children from this demon? So I've got goosebumps just thinking about it. I really do.
But yeah.
So that is one that I would like to maybe delve into a little deeper, but I'm not sure if my skill as a writer is going to be able to match what I want to see on the paper. It would be a very tough road for me to go down. So that one gave me the most trouble, I will admit.
And see, and that was kind of almost my next question was, after the 13 books are over here in your series, will you kind of go back to something in this book, Into the Woods, and say, you know what, I really want to expand on that, and so I'm going to use that as the basis for maybe my next series or my next standalone that's going to come out?
That is a very real possibility, and I have been telling readers, you know, go read them. I don't care, you know, buy it, find it in the library, just take a look at it, and then tell me what one interests you the most out of the three that were brand new, because I am curious. I want to know what the readers think. But actually, the one that I may be following after The Hollows is not even in the compilation. That one is Perry, and she just came out of the blue. Now, I'll tell you, I am a plotter by nature. I love my plots. I love to know where I'm going. I never stick to my plots. I always throw them out and rewrite them, but I always know where I'm going. But Perry came out in 2 months of seat of the pants writing, and I just absolutely love her. I mean, it's still an urban fantasy, but I don't really have the werewolves. The magic is all in personalized, kind of like you might find in horror, in that the demons are very personal. They're affecting one thing. They're not affecting the world. They're affecting, you know, you. So Perry kind of takes that bent to it, and that might be the one that I follow. I really can't say a whole lot about it because my editor hasn't seen it yet.
Right.
I keep teasing her relentlessly about this, and the sad thing is that this book would not come out until 2016. So, you know, it's way out there. Of course, she would be working with it in 2015, and you know, that's how long my schedule is and how far ahead I work. But, yeah, I think Perry might be the one that I actually follow.
And so have you been getting already, since the book, and again, the book is called Into the Woods,
mm-hmm.
have you been getting a lot of feedback already that the book is just a little, almost a month old from fans already kind of clamoring for, hey, we need you to expand more on this, or we want you to expand more on this, or this and that? You getting those emails already?
I am getting those, and I am keeping mental track of what everybody likes. And what might actually happen is that I will take the best parts of each of those three and try to work them into the Perry storyline. I love being a writer because you can just mix and match and play, and you don't have to settle on anything until you're ready to submit it to your editor, and even then you can change it. So it's very fluid, and that works for me. So we'll see. You know, it's a ways out there. I have the luxury of time right now.
And now, kind of going back, like we started talking about earlier, is the dark urban fantasy genre. And like I mentioned to you kind of off the air, is I think that this is the biggest exploding genre out there. And what kind of, have your demographics now over like the last 10 books and the many years that you kind of been writing this, have they kind of changed? Have you started to see your audience maybe getting a little older? Has it gotten a little younger? Has it just expanded? What kind of have you seen in all the years that you've been writing this genre and to see its explosion and everything going on, from your vantage point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dead Witch Walking came out just about the time that the Dresden Files were making it big and the Hamilton books were like three or four out at that point. And Charlene Harris, she was just getting started. And then I came along. So I was, you know, right at the cusp. And I have seen a huge change in the demographics. Originally, my demographic was a little bit of mystery, a little bit of fantasy, and actually what boosted me was the romance market. Believe it or not, it was the romance market because I had a strong-willed heroine, and she kicked butt, and she was nice. She wasn't bratty or mean or snotty or anything. She was a nice person. You wanted to see her succeed. And that's some of the things that romance readers look at. Lately, I have been seeing, especially on my Facebook and in my regular communication with readers, is that I'm getting a lot more men. I've been getting firemen. I've been getting policemen. I've been getting a lot of military people. And I'm starting to tap into the hardcore science fiction people who would look at my covers and say, oh, no way, I am not reading a chick book. And they really aren't chick books. I mean, my background in reading was science fiction and fantasy. And so the elements in those traditional genres are important to me, of the fast-paced story, the logical magic, making sure that, you know, if you have any romance in there, that it makes sense, you know, and the woman's not saying, oh, I know you're bad for me, but I want to be with you anyway. No, it's like, turn around and run. So I have seen a lot of change. Now, the best thing for me is that the young adult market is starting to find me a little bit. I did write a three book series for the young adult market, and that went pretty well. It's the Madison series. But these readers have found me now with the regular Hollows books. And what I love is just in the last couple of years, I have seen families come up to me at the signing lines, and you've got the 16-year-old who's like, oh, my gosh, I'm meeting an author, and then you've got the mom who's standing behind there who read the books and introduced them to her, and she's very proud that her daughter is reading the same stuff. And then there's Dad who's also hooked on the books, and it's like, I can't believe I've got all three of these people hooked on the Hollows, and they're reading them, and they're discussing them at the dinner table, and it's just a really great feeling. So I think in the urban fantasy genre as a whole, it has the ability to get a huge demographic interested in it. Some of that is from like Harry Potter or the Twilight. You either like them or you hate them, but they did get people open to the idea of picking up a book that has a supernatural flavor to it.
Well, and the thing is that I don't understand is when you go to the movies, and let's just look at the movies, and let's look at the Resident Evil series, very strong, I mean, female lead. Underworld series with Kate Beckinsale, female lead. And you see a lot of men in those movies, and they love them, and they're watching them and everything else. So why wouldn't they? And I don't know if it's a simple fact of they're like, look, I don't want to be seen around town with this book because
it's,
of the
yep.
undercover or whatever.
I
but
think it's
they're
the
reading it in their house. Yeah,
yeah.
But they're reading it in their house.
And they're
and
enjoying
the
it. They're watching
like
it. They're right. watching it on TV. Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Hollywood has loved the dark urban fantasy genre. I mean, you can go all the way back to Bewitched. I mean, that's it's
right.
not dark, but it is urban fantasy.
It is. And it's fun. And it's funny. And it's good. And so. You know, as a male, I mean, I don't care if people see what I'm reading. That's just fine, and I have no problem in saying, yeah, reading this, you should pick it up, or, you know, read the back of the book. I do it all the time when people ask me, you know, what I'm reading, because a lot of the time I have ARCs, so they're like, what are you reading? Because it's just like a orange cover
plain
book.
Cover, yeah.
And there's nothing really going on, so I can hide it easier. But, yeah, and so that's what I'm curious about, was the demographic has to be changing in this genre, just for the simple fact that it is, like you said, it's hitting mom, dad, and kid now. And
mm-hmm.
I think that that's the best part. And now, does that change knowing, do you change kind of the way that you write the books now going forward, knowing that, hey, you know what, maybe I should give a little something for dad or a little something for mom, a little something for kid, kind of in there to kind of tie it all together?
No, I don't. I kind of feel like my writing sort of leans that way anyway, because I'd like to think I'm a well-rounded person and I can touch on all those aspects when I'm writing. I've in the Hollows, they've got a pet cat. I mean, and she's got a pet fish, and just things that anyone can relate to, because everybody's had a dog, you know, you've all had the goldfish that dies. And so I don't really try to plan my writing out so that I can hit those certain demographics. I will say that a lot of attention has been going to my covers lately. They aren't so romantic. Yeah, oh, don't I have a great cover artist?
Yeah, you do. They're good.
Oh, it's fabulous. We're kind of leaning towards mainstream a little bit. We're kind of poking on the, you know, knocking at the door of mainstream, but we're still trying to keep that fantasy element in there. It is, you know, covers in themselves are an immense art form. And when people come to me and they complain, oh, Rachel doesn't have curly hair on the cover, I just laugh, because
right.
it's like you have no idea what goes into these covers to get you to pick them up. And it's not the curly hair, you know.
No, it's not. I mean, if you look at the,
look
at the cover, I'll tell you, The White Witch, Black Curse, that's a cover. That's a cover. Do you look at the chick with the gun? Are you kidding me? And the fountain and everything behind, and the kind of like northern light green color. I mean, come on, really?
Mm-hmm. I like it when they give Rachel a weapon. They've only given Rachel a weapon twice.
A couple times. Yeah, there's been
a
knife. A
White Witch, Black Curse,
The black magic one. She has a knife.
Does she have a knife in that one? Okay,
Black
and
Magic,
I know she's
ancient, yeah.
got a gun in Outlaw Demon Wales. But, yeah, it's been a while since she's had a weapon, so I'm very curious to see what happens in the next couple books. And she doesn't really use a weapon in the book, but it tells you what you're going to find in the pages. Yeah.
And so you said you kind of wanted to explore your writing maybe a little bit after the Hollows series are over. And did you have any one kind of particular genre that's like, okay, this is what I kind of want to explore, maybe a little outside dark urban fantasy where people are going to, you know, you might take it way kind of the other way to say, I'm going to try this and see what happens.
I have. I'm trying to get my next series to be more. I've got a couple things I'm trying to do with my next series. I'm trying to make
it a series. Okay.
I can't write standalones. They always evolve into series.
Because you just sort of fall in love with the characters. You just want them to continue.
I do. I get really invested in the characters, and I want to know, you know, what's going to happen from the choices that they've made in this first book. It's not all going to be roses and sunshine.
Right.
It's you pay for the actions that you've done. But with this next series, I would like to tilt it a little bit more towards mainstream. And still keep that urban fantasy feel. That's why I'm getting rid of the monsters, you know, the vampires and the witches, and making the magic more, you know, that a person has been gifted with or evolved and developed. So it's very person-oriented rather than creature-oriented. And yet I'd still like to bring in just a touch of mystery. I feel like I can't really write a very good mystery yet, and I need to work on that as an author. But probably,
you mean like a whodunit, kind of like whodunit
mystery?
Yeah,
history? Yeah. Okay. Not so much a whodunit, but more of a, I don't know what is going on here, but it's impacting my life, and I have to figure out why this is happening, kind of thing. It's a mix of Jason Bourne, and you know, that's the kind of feel I'm trying to go for, is that you're thrown into a situation and you have to react and take control of it. That's kind of what I want to do. I'd also, you know, I had a near brush with The Hollows with getting it on the small screen, and I think part of the reason why that fell through was because the mythology was so complex and the world was so big, and it was just a nightmare to try to pare it down and find out what the core is and then present that I would like to try to write something that would be easier for Hollywood to grasp and get a hold of and maybe run with. So, and I don't feel like I'm, you know, short selling my craft by trying to write for Hollywood, because that's the whole point, is to tell your story, and we'll see how that goes.
So that's interesting. I think you're one of the first authors I've ever heard basically saying, you know, maybe try to write, and bands do it, and they call it, you know, it's a commercial album. We're doing a commercial album where people can listen to the music on the radio, so therefore you can get involved with, because let's face it, you'll be 13 books, into a series that's finished, I mean, almost 20 books written with everything that you've done. Why not? Why not take the chance and see what happens? I mean, I think that it's a great thing to do, and turn a lot more people onto the backlist of stuff that you have, mm-hmm. and get a whole new fan base. Then Hollywood kind of looks back and says, wow, you know, this is really popular. Maybe we should, you know, revisit this, and I bet we can mm-hmm. do something with it. And I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I do too. I think the only way that The Hollows, because it's so complex, I think the only way that it will ever reach the screen is if somebody who's reading it now and loving it for what it is kind of grows up, shall we say, and starts producing movies and
right.
wants to make it. Kind of like The Hobbit. That's if you had a brand new person come through and say, oh, I like this book, I want to make it into a movie. No, that's not how it happened. It was somebody who read the books and loved it and got other people who read the books and loved it excited about it enough to tackle it. And I'm not saying that The Hollows is, the Tolkien books, but it is complex and it's multi-layered. And
right, it's
mythology.
Like an onion.
Mm-hmm.
Got to peel off
yeah.
a lot of onion layers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. Now, here, just kind of off the wall, what's kind of on your DVR? What are you watching TV show-wise?
Oh, what am I watching?
Yeah.
Oh, it has been a fabulous month for TV watching, because I love movies, and they always put the spooky, scary, weird stuff on in Halloween. So I will be honest, I've been watching a channel that I never watch because
AMC?
They have... I think it's a family channel. I'm not even sure who it is, but it's, you know, they've had like Hocus Pocus on, and they've had
ABC Family. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself now that Halloween's over. But I have been watching them because they're fun. They make you think. They're surprising. You know, but they're identifiable, you know, because it's the people that you might see walking down the street. So October is a very good month for me as far as watching movies, because anything and everything. Now I think I'll probably be going back more towards the thriller movies. You know, I'm starting to look for the James Bond and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Next weekend, Skyfall comes out. That'll be very interesting to see when that comes
it.
Out.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and that's
the other thing, is that it's great to be, because a lot of people probably think, oh, you know, you watch only these types of things because you write these types of books. And it's funny how people try to pigeonhole authors, I hear that all the time with different things, and they're like, yeah, no, really, I really like to watch Gossip Girl, even though I'm writing about the serial killer. I like Gossip Girl. You know, it's just funny that people don't get it, and it's like, yeah, you know. So, now, you know, real quick, what events or anything where people can kind of meet you at out and about? Are you doing anything? What else are you doing to promote yourself?
Well, right now we're on the tail end of promoting Into the Woods, and I did not get out for Into the Woods because it wasn't, you know, my big release. My next big release is January 22nd. Now, this is important because usually I'm at the end of February, and this year they bumped me up in the schedule, so I'm coming out. The book is Ever After. The ARCs are out, so if you don't have yours, you know, start looking for it.
Yeah.
It's Ever After. It comes out January 22nd, and that's the one that I'm going to start hitting the tarmac to promote. And right now, all I have on my website is the tour cities. New York got hit pretty hard, and everything has stopped unless it needs doing right now. It's not getting done. So I expect I will have some stores and times probably in a couple weeks, maybe by December. But that's when I'm going to get out and around. So right now they're just leaving me alone and letting me write the next book.
Well, Kim, we want to thank you so much for coming onto the show. Hopefully you add Los Angeles to that. I see you have San Diego, and we'll have to get out there and definitely meet you in person.
That'd be great.
And it's been fabulous to have you on again. The book is Into the Woods. KimHarrison.net is the website. Kim, thanks so much for coming on, and enjoy yourself.
Well, thank you, John. This has been great.
Yes, thank you. And maybe we'll try to get you on back in February. We'll talk about Ever After and see the adventures of what's going on.
I would love to do that. Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. So, again, everybody, Kim Harrison, KimHarrison.net. The book is Into the Woods, coming out late January, Ever After, next book in the series. Pick it up. We're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to be back with our next guest, Tasha Alexander. And you all know her, of course, from her series. And we will see you in just a second.
Thank you.
So welcome back, everybody, here from the break. As we come on to our last segment of the show today, we want to again thank Kim Harrison for coming on and talking about her book, Into the Woods. But now we are going to be joined with our next guest. She is author Tasha Alexander. She's been on the show before. She has talked about her Lady Emily series. This is book number 7 out now called Death in the Floating City. And we want to welcome Tasha so much for coming on. Tasha, how are you doing again?
I'm great, and it is just absolutely a pleasure to be back talking to you, John.
Well, thank you so much, and this is a good thing. Death in the Floating City, it's kind of a little great title for the simple fact that you're probably still floating a little on cloud 9 because of the great news that we just heard, and we talked about a little bit off the air, but I want you to like tell everybody what this great news is and what they're now going to see attached to your name.
Well, I am
forward.
In the absolutely amazing position of being able to say that the book has hit the New York Times list. It's number 30 for the week ending November 4th. I'm just absolutely beyond delighted. You hope for this, but it seems like it could never happen, and I just feel so incredibly lucky.
Well, you know, hey, it only took 7 damn books for them to realize that it should be on the list. So, but hey, better late than never, I guess, right?
Absolutely, heck, you know, that is worth the wait, let me tell you.
But now, the funny thing is, do you feel any kind of pressure now that you've hit the list to go, oh my God, now that you've hit it, now do you feel the pressure going forward with Lady Emily into book 8 and into book 9 going forward to say, oh, my God, are these books good enough now to get on the Times sellers? Am I going to fall down? Do you feel any like that, any anxiety?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you always have that anxiety. You know, you always want the next book to be better than its predecessor. I have a feeling that in a couple months I'll feel much more stressed about it. But right now, you know, I think it's so easy in life to go through and kind of gloss over the good bits and worry about the bad parts. And this is one of those rare things where, you know what, it's just good. It's good, and it's good forever. And, you know, it's one of those things that nobody can ever take away from you, and I'm really trying to just enjoy it. But I know I'll start worrying about you next year soon.
Right. I mean, and I think I heard you all the way from Chicago when you got the news. I was like, what is that yelling? And then Paulina, I mean, I said, "There, that's what it was."
Yes. When my publisher and editor and publicist called, I was just shaking so hard I could barely hear the phone. I could hold the phone. See, look, I can't even speak clearly now.
Yeah, you're like, no, you're your husband. Here, you take it while I go to the bathroom real fast, and then I'll come back.
Yes, exactly.
So, let's get into it here. Death in the Floating City, Lady Emily series number 7 book. What's going on with Lady Emily in this one?
Well, she is in Venice, and she's in Venice because a young woman named Emma Callum, who readers met briefly in the first book in the series, anyone who read that first book knows that Emma and Emily are not bosom buddies. They are, in fact, really enemies, frenemies, I guess, to be 21st century about it. Their mothers were very good friends, but Emily never could stand Emma and vice versa. And in that first book, partway through, Emma elopes with an Italian count and runs off to Venice. And I had put that little detail in because, you know, I needed Emma to elope and leave England, but I could pick where I wanted her to go. And at that point in time, you know, when I was writing that first book, I had no idea if it would get published, no idea if, you know, it could become a series and that it could become a series that was successful enough to, you know, go on for a long enough time that I could be in a position to write a book set in Venice, which was something I'd always hoped to be able to do. So I kind of put that detail in there just to sort of a secret hope of my own, you know, never said anything to anyone, but I kept thinking, you know, if everything goes really well, someday I can follow up on this and have Emily go to Venice. And part of the reason I picked to do that now, through the series, and I know we've talked about this before, I've been trying to bring Emily from sheltered society girl to a more educated, broad-minded, independent, strong woman with much more enlightened social views than the people she normally would be associating with in high society London.
Right.
So with Emma, in this book, what I wanted, it's so confusing, isn't it terrible having Emma and Emily, but, you know, I hadn't thought of that when I was writing the first book.
And, that's all right. That's, yeah.
You know, they're
that's
different
good.
Enough characters that I think it's hard to get them confused, actually.
Right.
But, you know, as you mature as a person, you eventually, everyone has to come to terms with the fact that, you know, you can't actually like everybody. And sometimes
I don't like most people.
Right? But the bad part is that doesn't mean you don't have to deal with them. Right?
Correct.
Because we
Correct.
All have people, bosses, relatives, frenemies,
especially,
whoever it is that you
relatives. Yeah.
Exactly. You can't just choose to not ever deal with them. And I felt that at this point Emily has matured enough that it's time to put her in a situation where she has to deal with this person who she doesn't really like. And, you know, Emma has a lot of very bad characteristics. She's not a particularly nice person. She's been living in Venice for 5 years, and she's never bothered to learn Italian because why should she? You know, she's not the model of the English traveler. And I wanted Emily to have to help her, because at the end of the day, if someone you know, even if it's someone who you don't particularly like, if that person is in dire need of help and you are the only person who can offer that help, you're going to help the person even though you don't like him or her particularly.
Right, yeah. Your moral aspects have to kick in just as a human being
exactly.
to be able to do those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what I didn't want to do was, because, I mean, obviously you could, you know, I could have written it so that, you know, Emily doesn't think she likes Emma and she goes to Venice and, oh, lo and behold, you know, she helps Emma and they become best friends and everyone lives happily ever after. Didn't want to do that because, you know, that's just not realistic. Sometimes
right.
people just don't get along. And that's certainly the case with Emily and Emma. And I didn't want to sugarcoat that.
So would you tell people that it would be do they need to go back and maybe reread And Only to Deceive, which is book one in the series? Can they go ahead and get it, you know, get Death in the Floating Cities and kind of do her thing? How do you think that they should maybe tackle this situation, knowing that, you know, it was 7 books ago, and maybe to try to remember that dynamic between the two?
Well, I think I deliberately wrote Floating City in a way that made it so that you didn't have to have read any of the previous books. If you remember Emma from the first book, that's great, but you won't really be missing something if
okay.
you haven't. I just felt like, you know, when you're doing a long-running series, it can be frustrating for readers who are new to your work if they can't jump in the middle. And so I really wanted to do a book where, you know, I could say wholeheartedly, absolutely, jump in, it's okay.
Right. And I think that that's important because, you know, like we just had Kim on and she had 10 books in her series.
Yeah.
Now you have 7 books in your Lady Emily series, that it's difficult to tell new fans, no, it's okay. You can read this book right now. And then you can go back and kind of do it. And I think that a lot of people are like, no, I got to read books one and this. Well, then you can do that too, but you don't have to. And so
exactly.
it's not that daunting task.
Exactly. And I mean, I admit freely that I am the anal reader who has to start at the beginning. And actually, my favorite thing is when I find a long-running series where there are already 10 books. And I haven't read any of them, and I can just get all 10 of them and stack them up and tear through them. I love doing that.
Yeah.
But not every, you know, everyone has a different way that they read. And so this way, you know, if you want to go back to the beginning, you can, but you certainly, you know, it's not going to ruin anything for you if you don't.
Yeah, and that's another important aspect of series writing is you probably have a crap load of notes and stuff everywhere that you have to keep going back to and saying, okay, what did I write in A Poison Season?
Yeah.
What happened in A Fatal Waltz? You know, I can't screw this up. And that's what makes it difficult writing a series, because you have so much information. I mean, heck, if your books are just 400 pages and you have seven, you got 2,800 pages you have to go back and figure out what's going on.
Yes, and you know, it's funny because I can remember times as a reader when I would be reading a series and you notice something, you notice a continuity error, and you'd think,
yeah,
how could the author do this?
Yeah.
But now that I'm a writer, I completely understand how a writer can do this, because you just cannot remember everything. You cannot remember every detail. And I try to keep track. I have a notebook where I write down things that I want to make sure the continuity is correct through the series. But at the very beginning, you know, when you're writing your first book, you're not sitting there thinking, well, I'm going to, in 10 years, still be writing this, so I better record every detail. I mean, that just seems like hubris, you know?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely it does.
So, and sometimes you have times where I actually, the book, the manuscript that I just finished writing for next year, I really was convinced that in one of the books, I had mentioned the fact that Emily had twin brothers who died from influenza. I swear I wrote this somewhere. I cannot find it anywhere. I've gone through all the manuscripts, you know, doing find and, you know, trying to find. But so I don't know if maybe I had just had that in my head or
If any of your fans that are listening and they listen to the replay and the archive, if you know, just simply email me, let me know, and I'll send it over to Tasha, and I'll tell her, hey, this is where one of your fans said this is where you did it at.
Yes,
so maybe
thank you, please. Because that's the thing. You don't always know what detail you need to remember.
That's true. You just never remember. Just like we're writing the series Green Lake, and it's ongoing, and I have these notes, and I'm like, oh, my God, I forgot. What kind of freaking car did he have back then?
Right,
and I
right.
have to go back to remember, was it a 67 or a 68? I have to find, go back, and I'm right. Oh, okay, it was this. And I'm like, I never knew I was going to need that again, but
that's
the story
right.
presented itself. Yeah, that
that's
way.
Right. No, it's tricky that way because you don't always know. You know, obvious thing, like if you physically describe a character and that sort of thing. But, you know, you can even get in trouble with that because you may have just thrown in a reference to eye color somewhere and not really – not thought to record it, you know, not, it's very easy to have that go awry, so I try not to, but one of these days I think I'm going to have to just sit down with all of the books and go through them line by line and make sure I have everything.
Absolutely, and when you look back now, seven books, did you ever expect, and I probably asked it more, but now that you're going forward, did you ever expect Lady Emily to be this way, when you wrote her in book one, did you think that this is the kind of path that she was going to take into book seven? Or has it been changed for you? And now you kind of changed, you know, topics, and you kind of changed the way that, because she wanted to go a certain way.
Well, I would say, I think she is pretty much where I expected her, because the one thing, I tend not to plan ahead a lot. So in terms of plot or settings for books or, you know, what kind of topic I'm going to address in any given novel. I haven't planned the series ahead that way. But what I have thought about a lot from the very beginning was how I wanted Emily to grow over the course of the series. And so she's been very, very thoughtful about sticking to that arc for me. But you know, it was a pretty broad arc. And I never, you know, I knew I wanted her to be more independent and that she would be, you know, she and Colin have had their tensions with her insisting on investigating murders and, you know, putting herself in harm's way, which is unfortunately something that happens in the course of these kinds of investigations. And, you know, when they got married, he was happy about that. But then, you know, things change when the person you love is actually doing it. And so I knew that would be a tension for them, but I knew that they would get through it because that's, you know, I've always tried to write her as a very real person and not try to let her take on a 21st century sort of psyche. You know, she is very much a Victorian, and so is Colin. And so I've tried to have her grow and become more enlightened, but in a Victorian way. So she's, you know, slowly going along the trail that I did hope she would stay on.
Yeah, and the one thing I do want to mention, too, I don't want to forget, is next weekend you're going to be in Muskego, Wisconsin, for Murder and Mayhem. And I know, and the that's I guess that's a smaller kind of conference.
It is. It is a fantastic event at the library in Muskego, and you know, it's just there's an evening reception on a Friday night, and then all day Saturday there are panels by authors. It's a small group, so you get it's just a little more intimate, and it's wonderful. Great people. It's always a really good time. You know, Ruth and John Jordan organize, and it's not possible to say enough good things about them.
Now, here's the big thing. We said that we are going to, on this radio show, you are going to give away an autographed copy of the book, Death in the Floating City, for someone who listens to the show and they have to kind of answer a question. And
okay.
So here's going to be the question that they're going to have to answer. And we just said this ahead of time. And I'm just going to ask you simply, what TV show are you enthralled with right now that you just cannot stop watching?
Ooh, that's hard. That is a hard question. Well, you know, my thing is, because I just go through box sets, DVD box sets. I never watch anything
okay.
when it's on. Because
what's the last one that you watched?
The last one that I watched, what was the very last one? Well, you know what, let's do the one that I just started. It's a BBC series called Parade's End.
Parade's End.
Yeah.
So that would be the answer to the question, people. Parade's End, when I post it out there. What it's about, I've never heard that. So it's a BBC series, so of course it's set in England.
Yeah, it's Edwardian England. It's based on a novel. But I mean, I've only watched the first 15 minutes of the first episode. But it's about a society marriage in England where the wife, it starts off pretty racy because this woman is in a train compartment and this young gentleman comes in, and that the two of them are alone in the train compartment and actually wind up having torrid sex in the train compartment.
Wow.
And she winds up pregnant, and he's not really sure if it's his child or not, but he marries her, and she really doesn't want to be married to him. And I'm not far enough in to know what her whole motivation for all of this was, but they're starting off with a mess. And
damn, that's a lot in 15 minutes.
Right. Right. Well, because it's just, you just sort of boom, boom, boom. That's the setup, basically.
Oh,
I think the series will be about the marriage, and there's a love triangle, and he winds up off in World War One, and, you know, this is all I know so far. So.
Wow.
I think anyone who liked Downton Abbey would probably really love this.
Oh, okay. I got you. Yeah, I've been hooked right now going on Netflix, and I've been watching all of the Perot series with David Sackett, and he's the reverse. Oh, I've been watching all of them. Oh, my God, I love those things.
Those
I
are great.
Them.
My son has just been on a rampage of Derek Jacobi and Cadfael. Did you ever watch those?
I've never watched those. I haven't even heard about them.
Yeah, they're based on Ellis Peters' books. So 12th century monk who was a former crusader who solves mysteries.
Oh, interesting. So, and that's, I mean, it's a little earlier than yours said in the Victorian age, but it's kind of, hey, it's the same thing where when you watch those shows, what I like about them is just the clean aspect of actual detective, not CSI, none of this NCIS, computer, this and that. You actually had to use your brain, your instinct, your eyes, all of your senses. You had to do it all in order to do it. And that's the one thing that I was, that we talked about before, too, with your series. That's the same thing that Lady Emily kind of has to do. You have to use all of those things. And that's why when you said it, and people might not realize until they see the covers, and they might say, wait a second, what is it's set in the Victorian age.
Right.
That's the great reason why.
Yeah, it's a whole different game when you don't have the technology. And there, like you said, we've talked about this before, but, there are pros and cons to it because there can be times when it's enormously frustrating.
It can be.
But then you also don't have to worry about cell phones.
That's right.
You know, and
I wish we did. I wish I didn't have to worry about a freaking cell phone right now.
I was out this morning. I had gone out to the farmer's market, and I came back home just for a minute. I had to run back out again, and I left my cell phone at home. I was cell phone free for a couple hours, and it was fabulous.
I know, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so you're almost like sometimes you get, and sometimes you can even get a little anxious, like, oh my gosh, I forgot my cell phone. And then when you actually stop and think about it, you're like, I forgot my cell phone.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And
this
you
is
know,
great.
We used to live without them.
Yeah, I know.
But you know, it just really, when you don't have the technology at your disposal when you're writing or when you're reading, you know,
right.
I think it's just, it makes your brain work in a whole different way. I remember hearing Chuck Yeager, the fighter pilot, you know, broke the sound barrier, give a lecture once, and he was talking about, somebody asked him what his favorite plane to fly was, and he's flown every plane that the Air Force has ever had, and he said that the Mustang was his favorite. And the person asking the question said, well, yeah, but what about, you know, these hot jet fighters now? And he said, you know, you don't even feel like you have a feel for the plane because it's all computer.
Exactly.
So,
it almost can fly itself.
Exactly. And, you know, if you've just got to swipe, you know, get some DNA and get this and get that, that's very different from figuring things out.
Right. And that's the part that technology has also hurt is it's hurt socially aspecting of people. And it's also,
definitely.
And it's done it in books. Because if you have CSI and you're just swabbing some DNA and this and that, you don't literally have to talk to, you don't have to talk to a suspect. You're like, look, we got your DNA. We know you were there. So you don't
right.
have to talk to see if they're lying or what they're going on. And so just missing it socially with teenagers, with Facebook
mm-hmm.
and everything else, they're writing all this stuff because they all feel like they can write it. And so they put it all down on, you know, on Facebook. But when they're actually confronted with it, they're all socially awkward. They don't
exactly.
know what to do anymore.
It makes it so difficult to have human contact.
I know.
I
don't know what's going to happen after I die. I could just see I could see the society just becoming a society of robots.
Right. No one ever has to leave their house. They're all just on Twitter and Facebook having food delivered. Not that I am not the first person to be guilty of sitting in my house having food delivered.
Yeah, but it was a different thing because you're watching Parade's End and that 15 minutes you couldn't leave because the whole freaking thing happens in 15 minutes. How can
right.
you leave when all that happens?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, you go to the bathroom and you come back and your husband's like, oh, you don't believe it, you just missed in 5 minutes.
Exactly.
You can miss it in 15.
But I think you really, when you have to, in fiction, rely on the human element and figuring things out and you know, It to me, one thing that's always interesting in crime fiction is when you have a villain who you have a certain measure of sympathy for,
mm-hmm.
you don't agree with them. You don't think they did the right thing, but that you have that tug where you kind of think, wow, yeah, I can see how somebody in those set of circumstances would have done this.
Right.
And if you don't have that getting to know the human side, you can't really have that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I agree with all that. You just can't, and it's sad to kind of see the way they've done it and nowadays. But what are you gonna do?
Well, exactly.
It,
well, and I think now, people who, if you're writing a contemporary thriller, I guess one of the things you have to do is just figure out how you can make it so that, you know, you don't have cell phones every 5 minutes. You know.
Yeah.
There's no service. The cell phone got stolen. You know.
I know. Now, so, again, we're speaking here with Tasha Alexander, TashaAlexander.com, New York Times best-selling author of her latest book, which just came out, Death in the Floating City. And going forward, do you have a lot? I see a lot of authors doing this on Amazon, and you kind of see that there's a lot of these Kindle singles coming out. Have you thought of maybe doing something like that to expand a little bit more on Lady Emily, something that might not be a whole book, just like a little novella to maybe expand on her on something that you wanted to do? Is that in the works? Is that coming up?
Well, I have really given that a lot of thought because there are a few things where, you know, you get interesting bits about a character that really aren't, that don't lend themselves to a plot big enough to be a whole book. But that
mm-hmm.
could be a great little story, you know, somewhere between a short story and a novella, you know, a short novella, something like that. And I would like to do that, not just because it's fun to explore those aspects of the character, but it also, you know, it's nice for readers to get something, not have to wait a whole year for something new. And so
yeah, that's the big thing. You can put out right away.
Yeah. And so I'm actually thinking about, because I've got the manuscript that I finished writing, I guess I finished it about a month ago, and my editor, you know, has given me notes, and I just have a couple light revisions that I need to still do. But I think I may, before I jump into the next book, just do something short like that. I have a couple ideas kicking around.
Okay. But Lady Emily is going to keep continue. There's not going to be any standalone or any stray from the series or anything else like that in the near future. You don't see that coming out.
No, no. I just, you know, I'm having too much fun with her.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people might have a lot of anxiety to be like, oh, please don't let her go away.
Yeah.
But sometimes you get these thoughts and you're like, hey, I got this great idea, but I don't think she's going to fit in, but I still want to write it. And,
right.
You know, those things happen.
They do. And, I mean, I could see that happening eventually or at some point. I mean, you know, there are times when you get, you know, I've had a topic that I've been interested in for a while that is Victorian, but I don't know that it would necessarily fit with Emily that I'd love to explore. But right now, I really like doing Emily.
Well, you know what you can do? I'll give you a little hint. You can write a character in your next book that will fit into that plot line. Then you've already talked about them.
Ooh.
And then all of a sudden you jump them out into that next plot line, and then it still has that tie-in.
Now you're thinking. You are brilliant.
Yeah.
That's a very good idea. That is a very good idea.
Yeah. So you create the character knowing that you're going to jump them out into something else, and then you already have it built in, and it's already right there, and it's tied into Lady Emily, and now you're starting to create this world. So now you're starting to create this entire bigger world just around your book.
Yeah. No, that's a really good idea. Well, and
if it works, you don't have to, if it works, just take credit for it. Just say, hey, this is what I thought of.
I love it.
So, well, I'll tell you what, Tasha, we are like out of time, and it has been great to talk with you. No, I mean, like I said, it couldn't have happened to a better person and a better author that your seventh book, Death in the Floating City, hit the New York Times bestseller list. Nothing but congratulations from us. It is tremendous news. And, again, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. And I really appreciate all the support you guys have given me over the years. I couldn't do it without you.
Well, thank you. And you know what? We open invitation anytime. You email, come back on the show, talk about whatever's going on. And, of course, book 8, Lady Emily. If you decide to do any kind of little novella here and there or anything, just let us know.
Oh, I will definitely do that. It is always just a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Thank you, Tasha. And have a great time. And, hey, stay cool in the winter. Or actually
warm
in the winter,
yeah.
I guess you want to say, right?
You enjoy that lovely weather you have.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's 80 today.
Yeah, it's
all
cool
right
here.
All right. But have a good one, Tasha. We'll talk with you later.
Okay. Thanks so much. Have a
all
great
right
weekend.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
you
bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, Tasha Alexander. TashaAlexander.com is her website, New York Times bestselling author of Death in the Floating City. It's the latest book in the Lady Emily series. Pick it up now. It's out wherever you can find books. Again, we want to thank Kim Harrison for coming on, and that's KimHarrison.net is her website. So you go check out her book, Into the Woods, and again, late January is her book Ever After coming out. Check all that stuff out. We, in turn, will be back, I believe, in a couple weeks with our next show. Check out suspensemagazine.com. Click on that little Suspense Radio button. You'll see the schedule coming up. And don't forget, the November magazine is coming out in a couple days. Email editor at suspensemagazine.com. And if you know the answer to the question, and you already listened to the show live, or you're listening to it now, simply email us, put Tasha Alexander in the subject line, put your answer. You'll have a chance to win an autographed copy straight from Tasha. She will autograph it to you, and you'll get it. Until then, everybody, have a good one. See you later. We're out of here.